Okay.
Over to you.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Denis, and for that kind introduction. It's a real pleasure to be here. And thank you to you for being prepared to listen to me speak in English on this question of what is constitutionalization. I will try to... I have a long paper, as Denis knows, but I will not try to read the paper. I will simply try to provide... I'll speak for 30 minutes or so and try to speak slowly. I normally speak slowly and leave plenty of time for any questions, and then I can elaborate on points in the paper that may be unclear, whether because of my formulation or my accent. The question I posed is, what is constitutionalization? This, I believe, is a new term. By a new term, I mean it's a term that has come into prominence only in the last 20 years or so. In the English-speaking world, there are electronic retrieval systems such as Pyn Online or JSTOR, where we can get virtually all of the English language law journals online. If one puts a search in for the term constitutionalization, a full text search, we find that the word hardly appears in the law journals in the 1950s at all. Only one or two, a handful of uses of the term. And it's only from probably the 1980s that we see the exponential growth in the appearance of this term, constitutionalization, in the academic legal literature. And this is a puzzle. Why is this occurring, and what is constitutionalization? That is, not constitutions, not constitutionalism, but constitutionalization. Constitutionalization seems to stand as an expression of a set of processes that are affecting all levels of government, whether they are local, regional, national, supranational, or international. And it concerns the attempt to subject all governmental action within a designated field to the processes, principles, and values of a constitution. But although this is a phenomenon having an impact across all the levels of government, I think its prominence today is mainly attributable to the realization that the activity of governing is now taking place in transnational or international organizations that aren't subject to the control of national constitutions in a way that historically, during for much of the 20th century, public power has been. And my interest in this question of constitutionalization largely comes because of the fact that I spent a year in Berlin at the Wissenschaftskolleg last year, in a study group looking at constitutions beyond the nation state. And I was the only non-native German speaker. And all the Germans were really concerned with this phenomenon of transnational power, public power being exercised. There was a presumption that this is public power. It has to be subject to a constitution. For the British, who don't have a constitution in this modern sense, it was a puzzle. Why are you so concerned about governmental power having to be subject to these constitutional forms? And this is my answer to the puzzle: what is constitutionalization? So, in this presentation, I want to deal with very basic questions, and I think we need to go back to basics to understand this question of what is constitutionalization. I want to talk first about what are constitutions, and then about what is constitutionalism, and then what is constitutionalization. Let me start with constitutions. If we use the word constitution today, we generally mean a document drafted in the name of the people for the purpose of establishing and controlling the powers of the governing institutions of the state. And this type of understanding derives from the American and French revolutions of the late 18th century. Through these revolutions, we came to accept that political power ultimately rests with the collectivity, the people, and that we the people, delegate this power to institutions of government on the basis of some notion of consent and on certain terms and conditions. And the terms of that compact, that social contract between the people and their governors, is incorporated in a document that we call the Constitution. Since the late 18th century revolutions, many states have, at critical moments in their history, adopted these modern constitutional documents. Almost every state, bar one or two, my own being the obvious example. Most of these modern constitutions, not all, but most of these modern constitutions are underpinned by a republican sensibility. That is, they promote a particular theory of government based on contract, on the enumeration of powers, and on the protection of a citizen's basic rights. So these modern constitutions seem to be founded on a principle of limited government. This principle of limited government is mainly expressed through a political theory that we call constitutionalism. The theory of constitutionalism has exerted such an impact over the drafting of modern constitutions that we often conflate the two terms. But I want to keep them distinct for the moment. And I'm going to talk about constitutionalism soon, but let me ask first three basic questions about modern constitutions. First, how do they differ from the older idea of a constitution? Secondly, what are their key characteristics? And thirdly, how do these modern constitutions mesh with modern social realities? First, the difference between ancient and modern constitutions. The ancient sense of a constitution treats the state or the collectivity, the collective enterprise, as an organic entity. And as an organic entity, well, I have a body, and my body has a constitution. It's made up in a certain way. The ancient sense of a constitution draws on that metaphor. The ancient idea of the constitution expressed the health and the strength and the mode of working of a nation publicly organized. And the constitution evolved as the nation itself increased in its vitality. This was the meaning that Edmund Burke was drawing on when he was reflecting on the revolution in France and saying that a constitution is not a mere contract. It's not a document. A constitution expresses a political way of being of a people. And understood as such, constitutions can no more be made than a language is made. Like language, constitutions evolve from the way of life of certain groups that come to conceive of themselves as a people or as a nation. These modern documents no more provide the source of the nation's constitution than a grammar book provides the source of a language. And it's not just Edmund Burke, it's not just an Englishman saying, no, he's Irish, sorry. We see it all exactly the same sentiment expressed by the French counter-revolutionary thinker Joseph de Maistre. And so there's a difference between, well, I'll come back to that, but the second, let me move on to the second issue, the characteristics of modern constitutions. Because it was that ancient sense of a constitution that was deliberately jettisoned with the French and American revolutions. This is probably most simply expressed by looking at Thomas Paine's Rights of Man. And we see Paine in Rights of Man say, look, there are four key elements of a constitution. And if these elements aren't in place, there is no constitution. First, it is a document. Secondly, it is the act of the constituent power of the people to establish institutions of government. Thirdly, that act, that constitution, that document must be a comprehensive statement of the powers of the government. And then finally, the document in which those powers are enumerated, are listed, has the effect of, has the status of fundamental law. The key point I'm trying to emphasize here is that while the modern constitution is directed to the constitution of the office of government, to the institutions of government, the ancient idea is addressed to the constitution of the nation. They are two different things. They're not entirely unrelated, but their focus is different. And the point of Burke and Mestre's argument is to say that these documents don't command authority of themselves. In order to be worthy of respect, they have to be seen to be sacred documents. And this is a tension in the work of modern constitutions. It helps us to understand the ambition of modern constitutions. Because establishing the institutions of the framework of the institutional government is one thing. Forging the bonds of unity of a collectivity, let's call it a nation, is another. Yet this is what modern constitutions are expected to do. They are required to serve both instrumental and symbolic functions. The instrumental function is future orientated. It establishes a set of institutions that guide decision-making in the future. The symbolic function provides the point of unity, seeks to bind a multiplicity of people together as a unity that we call the people. And for that purpose, it's drawing primarily on the past. It's a sacred task. And when we can't rely any longer on the power of religion or on what Weber calls the eternal past, the appeal to the myths of the history of people, it is incapable of being fulfilled without developing what Rousseau calls a civil religion. So, although presenting themselves as instrumental documents, modern constitutions also perform the function similar to the ancient understanding of nation building. And this is a very delicate, complicated task, which means that when there's a critical break in the development of the history of a nation and a modern constitution is established, sometimes they have to go back and appeal to the mythical past in order to establish the authority of that document. Sometimes that becomes very difficult because the objective is to move forward and to break with the old regime. And then they have to invent new myths, new symbols, flags, public holidays that celebrate the great achievement of the people at that critical moment when they marked the break and modernized. And for some, this becomes an impossible situation, as indeed is the situation with the formation after the war of the Federal Republic of Germany. And it leads to the type of claim that's exemplified by Jürgen Habermas, that we are now living in a post-metaphysical age, and it's orientated to the future, and we can't look back at the past, we can't appeal to the history of the German nation in order to bolster our symbols of unity. The only justifiable source of allegiance is the set of principles of liberty and equality that are declared in the constitutional document itself. Sorry, I'm taking a bit longer than I should here. I'm getting carried away with the Constitution's point. The third issue, very briefly, the third question I want to deal with constitutions was the relationship between civil society and government. Because in the ancient sense of a constitution, we talked about sovereignty. But when we read Paine on rights of men, it is quite clear that although he occasionally continues to use the language of sovereignty and to say that sovereignty vests in the nation or the people, it's obvious that he wants to abandon the language of sovereignty. And he draws a distinction between civil society and government. And what Paine is saying is that in the modern world, we are being driven by natural laws of social development. These are the laws that are opening up trade and commerce. And it's leading to the formation of a new phenomenon that he calls civil society. And it's civil society, rather than government, argues Paine, that elevates mankind. As civil society evolves, as civilization develops, government, he argues, dissipates. Government becomes a smaller, more task-orientated, limited function. So what Paine is actually trying to do is to abandon all of this language of sovereignty and to say, really, there is society and government. And government is the handmaiden of society. Government does what society requires. And society, for Paine, is a very positive... The laws, the natural laws you're talking about, are the laws of political economy. These are the laws that will bring about liberty and equality. Now, that's a contentious statement. Hegel entirely disagreed with Paine on that notion of the balance between civil society and the state. And for Hegel, the growth, the emergence of civil society would lead to greater inequality. And therefore, it was a barrier to the realization of what he would call objective freedom. But I set that up because how one characterized the relationship between society and government, liberalist, a liberal notion, or a more communitarian notion of a representation of the people, obviously affects the way we think about the function of constitutions. Because for Hegel, Paine's type of constitution that entrenches the powers of civil society and invests rights that protect government from interfering with those the workings of civil society is a barrier to the realization of objective freedom. I will be very brief. They're the three issues on constitution. I'll be very brief on constitutionalism. I just want to make one general point about constitutionalism. And the point is most easily made, for me, anyhow, by looking at a classic work on constitutionalism, the Federalist Papers, the papers written by James Madison Alexander Hamilton and John Jay in presenting the defense of the federal constitution of the United States to the people in 1787. And when one reads the Federalist Papers, we see, I'm going to expand the differences, because what I want to argue is that we get two different images of constitutionalism between Hamilton and Madison. And to simplify, I would say that Madison gives us what I will call political constitutionalism, and Hamilton gives us legal constitutionalism. Both believe in limited government. Both believe in the necessity of institutional constraints. Both believe in the need to protect the rights of the people from the potentially oppressive powers of government. But what Madison does is focus on the institutional framework created by the government to establish a series of checks and balances. Whereas Hamilton's focus is much more centralizing and centralist and more rationalist, and he places greater faith in the power of specific rules of the Constitution enforced by a judiciary to maintain this limited government. The point I'm trying to make, and I'm not going to be able to do it very well in 2 or 3 minutes, is that Madison does not believe in judicial review. Madison believes there are three major institutions of government, legislature, executive, and judiciary, that each have their roles and that each are coordinate institutions, and none has the final ultimate authority to determine what the Constitution means. So he sets up an institutional framework of tension, of balance, where they each check one another, but it's a state of irresolution. And the point I'm trying to make is that's a conception of constitutionalism, but it's politically orientated because it requires a political interaction between the different institutions. Hamilton promotes the necessity of the judiciary to act as the guardians of a constitutional document and be the final, ultimate, supreme deciders of the meaning of the text. So the text becomes, the constitutional text becomes a species of positive law, and judges, as the interpreters of the positive law, are the final authoritative determinants of the meaning of the Constitution. And of course, the point I'm trying to make is that the history of the American constitutional development is the history of the rise of legal constitutionalism and the decline of political constitutionalism. That's a crude and crass and general remark, but I'm making it to get across the general point. We are losing the sense of political constitutionalism, which brings me now, finally, thankfully, to constitutionalization. Because if you have followed my argument so far, if you have really followed my argument so far, which is probably more clearly than I've... That is, you followed it more carefully than I probably presented it. What I'm trying to suggest is that in modern constitutions there's a problem because of that dual function of the instrumental and the symbolic. And in constitutionalism, there's a tension between the political and the legal. But when we come to constitutionalization, it is quite clear, this is the it's quite clear to me, but it's a contentious argument, that what's being promoted is legal constitutionalism based on the self-standing authority of a text. And often the self-standing authority of a text that doesn't have reference to a people. So constitutionalization is, to my mind, a rather contentious phenomenon. So, we've had this phenomenon of constitutionalization in the last 20 or so years. Why is this the case? Well, first, we've had the last 20 or so years as being a period in which scholars and activists have talked about constitutions almost in a way that they never have had before over the previous century. During most of the 20th century, constitutions were not very central to the exercise of political power. We saw the rise of welfare regulatory states, and constitutionalism was this 18th century philosophy that related to a world of limited government. Well, we were living in a world of ubiquitous government, where government was, through its powers of command of the economy, was running services and regulating all spheres of not just public but also private life. And somehow the idea of this notion of the constitution being the central it might remain symbolically, but it didn't actually tell us much about how governmental power was being exercised. What we've seen is the dismantling of welfare states, the rise of neoliberal philosophies of government, and we've seen a lot of states across the world devising new constitutional settlements, whether it's because of post-communist regimes or post-fascist regimes or post-apartheid regimes. We are seeing that there's been a spate of new constitution making over the last 20 or 30 years. And these constitutions, not just the new one, but also the re-engaged constitutions, are tied to an underlying social and economic program. So when we look at the phenomenon of constitutionalization, we see, I think, that constitutionalism is no longer treated as being a flexible theory that is rooted in a particular state tradition. It owes very little to political constitutionalism. We see, secondly, that by constitution in constitutionalization, we mean the text. And the text itself is read as a series of self-sustaining propositions. The authority of the text is the rationality of its principles. It's not authoritative text because the people have designed this. It's authoritative because it expresses principles of liberty and equality that are of self-evident, rational standing. And the phenomenon of constitutionalization, thirdly, presupposes legalization. Constitutionalization, it seems to me, is a centralizing philosophy. It proclaims basic rights as often as trump cards in the political game, and it maintains that the nature, status, and scope of those rights must be determined by a small cadre of senior judges in the rarefied atmosphere of Supreme Courts. And then finally, constitutionalization absorbs a lot of Paine's liberal ideology on the relationship between society and government. I've said all that without saying anything about the detail of constitutionalization, though I'd better finish by actually saying something about what I mean by the phenomenon of constitutionalization. Although I said at the beginning that the emphasis was the concern amongst many academics, many scholars, was with transnational developments, we have seen the phenomenon of constitutionalization expressed at the domestic level. And the phenomenon is of a piece with the operation of constitutionalization at the international level. In many states, there was a modern constitution, but as I've suggested, the ways in which government conducted its business was not self-evidently in alignment with what the constitution seemed to require. So in that situation, the constitution performed a symbolic function of presenting a public face of how we constitute ourselves to the nation itself and to the world, but it wasn't fulfilling its instrumental function of regulating the actuality of government decision-making. What constitutionalization does is to try to make the structures and the principles and the processes and the norms of that written constitution a more powerful control over the conduct of government within the domestic sphere. And it's driven primarily through a rights revolution. And this is a recent phenomenon. We talk about the United States as being the most rarefied idea of a modern constitution. And we talk about the rights revolution as being more deeply entrenched in the American system. But even in the American system, that rights revolution whereby all political questions of any significance end up as cases before the Supreme Court, that is a phenomenon only of the post-Second World War period, and it's probably only a phenomenon from the 1960s onwards. And what we see is that it's only in the last 15, 20, 30 years at most that other regimes have had the same rights mentality and have promoted rights, constitutional rights litigation through their Supreme Courts to the same degree. I'm not much of a comparativist, as it will be obvious by some of the crude statements I make, but in the English-speaking world, in the British Commonwealth of Nations, it's very easy to see this phenomenon. And in the British Commonwealth, we the British, gave the dominions their constitutions based on the Westminster parliamentary model. And over the years, we see them trying to move away from that sovereigntist parliamentary model by engrafting bills of rights into their regimes and to develop a notion of a rights foundation to that polity. And it's done in different phases and different systems, but it's a peculiar accommodation that reflects this rights revolution that is taking place throughout the Western world. But alongside domestic constitutionalization, we see the phenomenon of supranational constitutionalization. This, I'd better be brief on supranational constitutionalization. It takes, I think, two main forms. First, we look at transnational or international bodies, and we say these institutions, treaty-based institutions, are exercising governmental power, and they somehow are, through the undertaking of these specific tasks, expanding their power. And there comes a point where they seem to have developed a dynamic of their own, and we need to acknowledge that and to regulate this and to impose a constitution on these organizations. And we often see it with specialized organizations like the World Trade Organization. There's a huge literature. I don't pretend to understand it. There's a huge literature on the constitutionalization of the World Trade Organization. I can see its legalization, but I'm not sure how its constitutionalization, but there is a big debate that takes place on the World Trade Organization. But it's not just specialized organizations like the WTO. The United Nations now is, some scholars are saying, we have to look at the United Nations as the constitution of the world community, and we have to somehow treat the United Nations treaty as a constitution of that world order. And of course, we've had the debate on the European Union constitution. That's not the issue, the constitutional treaty. The issue, the key issue on constitutionalization, for me, I think, with the European Union, is a product of competence and capacity. That a treaty-based arrangement somehow transforms itself into a singular legal order, and through the working of its legal principles, expands its competence. So it engages through its own dynamic. It starts to interfere with more and more aspects of public life that we didn't think was part of the original compact we'd signed up to when we signed the Treaty of Rome. And it's mainly, when we see that phenomenon, it's mainly the work of the European Court of Justice enunciating or applying in innovative ways general principles that they have devised in order to provide for the effectiveness of the normative structure that is implicit in the Treaty of Rome. And so constitutionalization takes place when the institution sees itself as a self-sustaining evolutionary dynamic that might be subject to limited controls by the member states that established it, but it's no longer entirely the creature of the member states through their contracting powers. And the final aspect of constitutionalization I would refer you to is the phenomenon that we find a lot of continental European scholars now, in particular, now talking about thinking of public law entirely through this regime of multi-level constitutionalism. It doesn't apply to the British, doesn't apply to the French, I suspect, either. We should no longer treat the state as the nation state, as the key institution which authorizes the exercise of all public power. Public power is now entirely differentiated in a hierarchical sense. We have it operating at local level, we have it operating at regional level, we have it at a federal level. No, we're not talking about state, we're talking about, the heuristic concept of the state, which is talking about levels of government. We have the European Union, and we have international organizations, and we have transnational organizations. And we should simply look upon the public sphere as being a series of an intersecting series of constitutional arrangements. This is multi-level constitutionalism. But when we ask, well, who authorizes this? To whom are these this arrangement accountable? It's the beauty and the symmetry of the normative ordering that sustains the existence of this phenomenon of multi-level constitutionalism. It's a form, I think it's a form of legal imperialism. It's a form of lawyers, elite lawyers, enhancing their own power positions by conceiving public power to be entirely refracted through the legal documents, constitutional documents, of which they somehow have a unique insight as to the meaning of the text. And the judges are the critical actors in this phenomenon. But there are many other non-judicial actors who have powerful vested interests in promoting multi-level constitutionalism. On that, I'd better stop. What I've said, just to conclude, is I've tried to argue that constitutionalization is a new concept, I mean in modern history. I don't mean it's new this week or this year. But it's a relatively new concept, the expression of a new stage in the history of the evolution of constitutional government. It draws on some of the achievements of modern constitutions, and it draws on the political theory of constitutionalism, but it just jettisons, it ditches aspects of these phenomena, especially those that are rooted in the peculiarities of the history and culture of particular nations, and it asserts the authority of these texts. It's not the way of being of a people that provides the source of authority for constitutionalization, and neither is it the fact that it has been enacted by the people in a constitutional text. As a social philosophy, constitutionalization marks the elevation of certain constitutional norms, those expressing the principles of legal constitutionalism, to the status of self-evident truths. As a social movement, constitutionalization, allied to those restructuring forces that are sometimes called new governance, call different things in different systems. Does that make any new governance? I'll come back to it if anyone wants to deal with it in any questions. It's constitutionalization is allied to these changes, the restructuring of governmental forms, and it's allied in a way that imposes the discipline of constitutional norms over these practices of government. Now, the final point, and then I'll stop, is this. Jürgen Habermas, in his wonderful, massive theory of communicative action written in the 1980s, talked about the phenomenon of juridification as an aspect of his general theory of modernization. Habermas talks about juridification as a symptom of what he called the internal colonization of the life world. And it flows from the fact that social relations are increasingly being organized and regulated through the form of positive law. All social relations are now subject to legal regulation. And he outlines four epochs in the process of Eurydification. The first was absolutism. The second, the constitutional state, the Rechtsstaat. The third was what he called the democratic constitutional state. And then he said the last stage to date to emerge was the democratic welfare state. What I would argue, I don't have the profundity of Habermas here, what I would argue is constitutionalization is the fifth epoch of Eurydification. But what we find peculiarly is that Habermas has turned from being an analyst to a political intervener, and who is one of the main advocates of constitutionalization, whether it's at the European level or the global level also. And this is a strange twist. Similarly, Gunther Teubner, who analyzed Eurydification, Teubner wrote a paper in the 1980s that opens with this lovely phrase, Eurydification, an ugly word for an ugly concept. And yet, Teubner is now writing about civil societal constitutionalism, civil constitutions, and he's embracing these, as is Habermas, as progressive forms. All I'm saying is that there is a negative, there's an underside that's not quite as progressive to this phenomenon, and I don't think we should treat constitutionalization as a self-evidently good thing. I'm not going to stop.
Thanks very much.